around the world, around the country, around the block, and up your alley. This is Media Network on Radio Netherlands with Jonathan Marks.
Hello. Actually, it's not me, but your letters, faxes, and other messages that matter the most, plus the phone calls.
Hello, it's Tony Barrett calling from Newton Abbot in southwest of England with a message for Jonathan Marks at the Media Network programme. Just to wish you a very happy Christmas and all the best for the new year. And indeed, if you could pass that on to all your colleagues at Radio Netherlands. It's nice to have a European station that's really worth listening to.
Thank you. I wonder who that is in the background. Lots of reactions to our move to medium wave here in Europe. Greetings to Bo Nensen in Sweden, listening to the show on 1386 kHz each Thursday evening, as well as Vitaly Shevitz, who writes from Kiev in Ukraine. That transmission's even been making across the Atlantic, according to reports on the internet this past week. The east coast of Canada isn't too bad. Vitaly sends some valuable comments about the receiver shopping list, which we currently publish, and encourages us to consider a new edition in the course of 1995. He notes it's very difficult to get independent consumer information in the shops in his part of the world, and the price of commercial books published abroad is prohibitive. Robert Petratius, who lives in Klaipėda in Lithuania, notes that he would like to see more information in the receiver shopping list about bandwidth filters and the compromise that's made in many portables these days. A sharp filter is fine for digging stations out of the noise, but it also results in muddy-sounding audio, which is tiring to listen to for more than a few minutes. R.J. Harris in Zimbabwe is a regular listener and comments that he's managed to hear lots of new countries thanks to our suggestions on this programme. More input from the mailbag very shortly. First, though, time for some research.
Media Network. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
Lou Josephs is on the line from Boston, USA now, with a few items of technical interest. Lou, last time you were on this wireless program, you mentioned that the Federal Communications Commission was accepting applications from radio stations who wanted to use the newly expanded portion of the medium wave band over there, above 1600 kilohertz, up to 1705, in fact. Have there been any developments?
Well, Jonathan, one major thing has happened. They have issued who the stations are going to be on the expanded AM band, and those that didn't get a place are kind of upset, so they filed petitions to deny. At the moment, there are 14, and the list grows daily.
Does that mean to say then the expansion won't go ahead until these petitions have been heard?
That's correct, and if any one of these petitions is granted, it basically throws their whole computer plan out of balance.
So what do you expect to happen?
I expect that we won't see an expansion of the AM band, and by the time people get around to really implementing this, we'll be into the world of in-band, on-channel digital audio broadcasting.
Is anything happening on that score? Because if I remember rightly, USA Digital Radio were testing a radio station on AM out in Illinois, but has anything happened there?
Absolutely nothing at the moment. The most interesting DAB news comes from Europe, where the BBC has announced that by September 1995, they'll be broadcasting digital audio.
In fact, there'll be on-air demonstrations of DAB in Berlin at the Funkausstellung in August of 95 as part of a joint venture between Radio France International, Deutsche Welle, BBC, and Radio Netherlands. That venture is called European Digital Radio. A few weeks ago, we mentioned that one receiver manufacturer had started a major publicity campaign in several European countries for an RDS car radio, which records traffic news into a chip for later playback. RDS, the radio data system, is well established in many countries of Northern Europe. There have been attempts to get the same system adopted in the United States. So far, though, only a handful of stations are using the RDS system, which allows specially equipped radios to show call signs on the display. In fact, only a small part of the functional capability of RDS. It can do much more. Indeed, there are not many receivers on the marketplace.
There is, however, a computer company out in California who has an add-on computer board for your PC compatible that will enable you to receive RDS information at your home computer terminal. It basically is a small radio receiver that receives the RDS information and then displays it for you on your computer terminal.
But you don't see it going anywhere?
At this point, no. I think other things will probably eclipse it.
Like what?
I suspect that you will see radio stations become internet service providers, where the information that would have went on RDS will be available on a web server page.
Radio Netherlands, news and information from the west coast of Europe.
Mind you, if you tune across the dial in the US, there's a chance that you'll bump into a strange dual tone on the radio, followed by an announcement which says,
"This is a test of the emergency broadcast system. The broadcasters of your area, in voluntary cooperation with federal, state, and local authorities, have developed this system to keep you informed in the event of an emergency. If this had been an actual emergency, the attention signal you just heard would have been followed by official information, news, or instructions. This station serves the metropolitan Boston area."
Now, those tones, which we didn't play for safety reasons, trigger special receivers at other radio stations in the same area, so that if a national emergency occurs, all the stations switch over to relay the important message.
Well, right now it's tested once a week, and you get 20 seconds of two annoying tones. Come July 1st of next year, you only get 7 seconds of the tone, and you only hear it once a month, as the United States starts to move to a more digitally based system. Originally, it was set up in the way back when it was called Conelrad. It was set up on 640 and 1240, if you remember back that far, to prevent against a sneak attack against the United States, so that the governmental authorities would have some way of informing the population with news and information. Then they decided that, well, gee, a Russian bomber could home in easily on 640 and 1240, and maybe this isn't such a good idea, so let's disperse this and make it more survivable, was the terminology. So they created the emergency broadcast system, which would allow one station in each individual region to be a key station, and then filter out that information to a network of feeder stations.
So fewer noises on the radio, but maybe there'll be more tones on the wireless carrying low-speed data on shortwave about broadcasting stations. The clue is a noise that we tested some 12 years ago. Remember this? If not, cast your mind back to 1982.
Next week, Media Network's new phase of computer experiments. That's November the 4th. You don't have to be a broadcaster to do this sort of thing.
Thanks, Sherlock.
Elementary, Watson, my dear. Mono, my dear Watson.
The detective work was connected with some data we put out for home computer enthusiasts in the basic code format for computers like the Commodore 16 and Apple IIe. We had some success, but there were problems with the Optimod, and the noise was too annoying to take it much further than the experimental phase. Still, it would be useful if we could get a lot of schedule and frequency information across in a digital form, much faster than writing it all down. There have been attempts to do this. We had a call on the answer line this past week with the question as to what happened to the concept of the AM radio data system. Was it still alive? Deutsche Welle and Grundig were busy on a system to ensure that as you tuned in your favourite station on shortwave, the schedule of that broadcast was silently loaded into the memory banks of the receiver. Development of all that is still going on. Meanwhile, Pierre Schwab, who's developed a system called ID Logic, says a meeting took place in Hong Kong on December 6th and 7th, attended by delegates from BBC World Service, VOA, RFI, Deutsche Welle and RCI, as well as representatives from Sony, Philips and Sanjian. They got together in Hong Kong for 2 days to set in motion the implementation of a new worldwide standard for intelligent shortwave receivers, so it seems. I asked Pierre for more details.
What we are going to do with ID Logic is put a complete schedule of all the participating broadcasters inside the receiver's memory. The trick is to be able to update that memory automatically. The receiver will receive from the broadcaster some data that will be stored in the memory. That data will be sent by the broadcaster as it is generated by the frequency management people at the stations.
And how will that information get across the airwaves? I mean, do you have to tune in at a certain time, or is it continually being updated in the same way that radio data system works in Europe on FM?
Well, we have made provision for both ways, in fact. If we're going to send the data continuously, that means that we have to send it in an inaudible fashion. for this to happen, something has to be installed at each broadcasting site. And that may be a little bit difficult for certain broadcasters who do not own all of their towers. Some broadcasters do own all of their towers, and that would be easy for them. But a lot of the others would prefer to have a system which would not require the installation of any special hardware.
Turns out the alternative, then, is for shortwave stations to broadcast their schedule at a specific time, with a noise rather like a fax machine.
The other one would require simply the broadcaster to send digital data in short bursts, let's say 4 or 5 seconds, or perhaps 10 seconds, at the end of every hour of vernacular programming. In fact, they will hear a noise pretty much like a fax machine, if you will, for a few seconds, but there will be announcements saying, explaining what it is so that people won't think that their receiver has gone on the blink.
Which station is doing the test first, then?
I believe the BBC World Service will start firing these data bursts very soon, and possibly the other broadcasters that I have mentioned as well.
But around about 10 years ago, Radio Netherlands tried some experiments with computer data on the air and discovered that there was enormous problems with interference from the phasing, the ionosphere, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, haven't you got a problem with trying to get that digital data over in an audible form?
It seems that there, many tests have been done, and all the broadcasters who were present at the conference are going to run some tests beginning of 1995, over-the-air test, so that we can make sure that the system that we're going to choose will be robust and solid. One of the reasons why we chose the AMDS encoding is because there is error correction and error detection in that technology.
Of course, a lot of error technology has changed in the last 10 years.
Quite.
Okay, the tests are obviously going to be done by the broadcasters themselves. When do you think we're going to see receivers on the market?
Probably about a year from now, I would estimate. We had at the conference, we had three major producers of shortwave receivers who were quite keen on the technology.
So why are you investing this idea in sort of giving shortwave a bit of a kick when, of course, satellite technology and all that is going at the moment? I mean, is it a sort of last gasp for AM?
I don't believe so. We've talked about that at the conference, and some people think that shortwave will always exist in the present form. Some people even suggested that if there is a war, the first thing that comes down are all the satellites. And then shortwave broadcasting will still be very useful. But it is still the only free, totally free method for someone to send a message across all boundaries without any problem.
As well as a belief in AM, Pierre set up a feedback system through the Internet.
And we allow people to download a simulator that they can run under Windows so that they can see exactly how Ideologic will function with a shortwave receiver.
So what's your Internet address is the next question, I suppose.
If they want to use the worldwide page, they should use http://... www.hk.net/TildePRS. Quite difficult.
Radio Netherlands. The Dutch International. Service not included.
Back to your letters and comments. Richard E. Wood writes from Hawaii, way out there in the Pacific Ocean. Richard's authored many articles about shortwave listening in the past and wrote a course in the days of the Radio Canada Shortwave Club about languages and how to identify some of the more difficult ones you bump into on the bands. He remarks the reception of 6015 and 6155 kilohertz at 0330 UTC isn't all that brilliant at his location and suggests we return to the 31-meter band. Well, to be honest, Richard, we'd recommend 0730 UTC on 9720 kHz, since our definition of the west coast of North America really means the mainland west of Chicago. Our propagation predictions show that with the ever-decreasing solar activity, we'd be hard-pushed to reach California on 9 MHz at the moment. But I'm curious about one thing, since Richard comments that when reception is good, he plays recordings of this wireless station in his store. And that's pretty novel. Most of the time when you go into a radio shop, all you can hear is the fluorescent lights directly above you. Dick, meanwhile, has more transmitter news.
A few days ago, Jill Dibker, who lives in the USA, got a letter from RAI, the Argentine External Service in Buenos Aires. They said their transmitter normally puts out 100 kilowatts, but that it's working at half its usual power for the time being. Their English programming runs from 1900 to 2000 UTC on 15 345 kilohertz beamed to Europe and North Africa, with a repeat from 0200 to 0300 UTC on 11 710 kilohertz to the Americas.
Norwegian Public Radio NRK will close its long-wave transmitter at Kløfta near Oslo on January the 1st, despite earlier plans to increase its presence on long-wave. The 200 kilowatt transmitter on 216 kilohertz dates back to the 1950s and is too expensive to maintain. This latest closure means that Norway will no longer be on longwave at all. The fishing fleet at sea are served adequately by medium wave, 1314 kilohertz, and it seems, according to surveys, that most domestic listeners are now listening on FM.
Tom Sundstrom suspects that one of China Radio International's relay transmitters in Mali, West Africa, appears to have technical problems. At midnight, UTC, he notes spurious modulation products on approximately 11653.5 and 11776.5 kilohertz. The prime 11715 frequency sounds fine, but there may be arcing at the antenna.
Plans to modify the ionosphere with powerful radio shortwave frequency radiation are attracting attention as a prototype transmitter nears completion in Alaska. Opponents are raising concerns over whether the transmitter and a full-scale facility planned for the same location could interfere with communications, cause ionospheric heating, or even pose danger to people and to wildlife. The opponents are also challenging the premise that it's useful or wise to meddle intentionally with the Earth's atmosphere. I asked Louis Slesson, editor of Microwave News in New York, what's going on?
Well, it's a very good question, and certainly the residents of certain remote regions of Alaska would like to know the answer to that question themselves. The U.S. Military has a long-standing interest in being able to disrupt communication, especially in times of war. There is a great deal of discussion that by using these very high-power heaters that they can disrupt communication. There's also some discussion that they may be able to use such devices for submarine communications. Plus, of course, there's always the allure of pure scientific research and understanding the Earth we live on. You know, there is the darker side of the Star Wars of trying to zap electronics, and with that kind of power that we're talking about with some of these units, that's quite a possibility.
But is this then a project that's left over from the old Cold War, or is it something that is still needed?
Well, certainly many projects have, don't know that the Cold War is over. The atmospheric heater that's planned for Alaska seems to come from some Star Wars battle plan, if you will, rather than, a post-Cold War type of action plan. But it's sometimes very hard to know what the military is up to, and this is one of those occasions.
So what stage is this particular plan in now? I mean, if I understood correctly, it's coming online not too far away.
We're still at the prototype stage. The real question is whether they will scale up and do a full-scale test. This is not a small endeavor.
But the experiment out in Alaska consists of what? A combined power, if I read correctly, of 320 kilowatts.
This is certainly not a small amount of power, and there's a lot of research going on. But this seems to take it to a new scale, to a much larger type project. And when you were talking about these kinds of energies, one really must think that there's some kind of military application at work here.
But more in the case of disrupting the ionosphere rather than trying to rebuild it or whatever.
There is another idea here that maybe we can use this technology to communicate with submerged submarines. The military, of course, would like to be able to have instantaneous communications with all parties anywhere on the face of the globe. And they're willing to try pretty much anything to get there.
Somewhere in the world, someone writes to Media Network every half hour.
Back to Andy Sennett, editor of the World Radio TV Handbook, who's here with more media news gleaned from the bands. Andy, you mentioned the Commonwealth of Independent States last week, and there's a ray of hope for letter writers looking for verification cards from that area of the globe.
Yes, going back to Ola Alm in Sweden for a moment, Ola tells me that it's now possible to get a verification card from Turkmenistan after a long period when they didn't send out QSLs. Now, if you want to try and verify reception of this country, a good frequency to try is 5015 kHz, 5015, that's in the 60-metre band, where there's a 100-kilowatt transmitter at Ashgabat operating round the clock except between midnight and 01 hours UTC. And I've seen various reports of this being well received in North America in recent weeks. The full address for reception reports is Ulitsa, U-L-I-T-S-A, Molan Epeza, that's M-O-L-L-A-N-E-P-E-S-A, number 3, postal code 744-000, Ashgabat, which is spelled A-S-H-G-A-B-A-T, and that's in Turkmenistan. And by the way, a full revised listing for this country will be in the 1995 WRTH.
Bit of a spelling bee there. Ola's also been monitoring stations from India.
Yes, he's been hearing a couple of stations on new frequencies which are unfortunately not mentioned in the 1995 handbook. These are from new 50-kilowatt transmitters. Impal is being heard on 4775 kHz, 4775, while Jaipur has appeared on 3295 kHz, 3295, instead of 3345 or 4910 kHz. Now, this one's being heard in Sweden signing on at 0025 and again at 1430 hours UTC.
What about a fax there from the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting?
Yes, I have. It's to advise us that they have a new address and fax number. So this will also update the 1995 handbook when it arrives. Their new address is IRIB, P.O. Box 15875/1575, Tehran in Iran. And their fax number is country code 98, area code 21 for Tehran, then 204-1051.
OK, time for something seasonal.
Yes, as usual this year, Vatican Radio will be broadcasting the Pope's Christmas message. But apparently they're no longer using the shortwave transmitter that used to be located inside Vatican City. Now, until recently, it was operating on 6245 kHz. But a note from Alex Wellner on the Australian shortwave echo caught my attention. Alex wanted to know what frequency the transmitter was now using, as it has apparently been changed. So I checked the engineering schedule of Vatican Radio, and indeed it seems that all transmissions on shortwave are now coming from the main site at Santa Maria de Galleria, which is actually outside the Vatican, and therefore it counts as Italy if you're logging transmitter sites.
Thank you, Andy. I laughed last week at Andy's mention of the 1-watt Radio Caroline experiment on 1584 kHz. Well, Bent Erford managed to hear it up in Kristiansand in Norway last Friday at midnight UTC, so no more jokes from me about neighbourhood radio. Bent also mentioned that after a call to Radio Vanuatu, the latest is that their plans for new transmitters on shortwave have been delayed again. Approval is being held up by the Australian High Commission, it seems. 6100 and 3330 kHz are still scheduled, though, to get new 10-kilowatt transmitters, which will supplement the existing service from Vanuatu on 7260 and 3945 kHz.
On Tuesday, the Russians started using 1215 kHz for their Voice of Russia service from 1630 UTC onwards. It's coming from a 1200 kilowatts transmitter at Bolshakovo near Kaliningrad, and the antenna is a new directional array beamed towards northwest Europe. It's already causing some distress to listeners of Virgin Radio's synchronized transmitter network on 1215 kHz in the UK, since it's on the same frequency. And the problem's accentuated by winter propagation.
There's also news about the Voice of America and their activities in Europe. They've now secured an FM license in Berlin, sharing it with a local station. This move comes as a result of the close-down of the American Forces station in Berlin. BBC and Radio France International, representing two of the other Allied powers once in Berlin, already have frequency allocations in the city. VOA is also using a new medium-wave frequency for its Serbian service. 1593 kHz used to be a powerhouse signal from Westdeutscher Rundfunk in Cologne. They decided to close it down, but Radio Free Europe in Munich got the allocation moved to southern Germany, where it rented airtime from the German authorities to reach former Yugoslavia. Now, with the policy of combining resources of RFE and the Voice of America, VOA has Serbian on the air on 1593 kilohertz from a transmitter in Holzkirchen from 20:30 to 21 hours, from 22 to 22:30, and finally 23 to 23:30 UTC.
BBC Monitoring has just completed a £1.8 million investment at its receiving and listening posts near Reading, west of London in the UK. Caversham monitors broadcasts in over 70 languages, and there's increasing use of remote receivers at strategic points around the globe to hear local FM or AM broadcasts, which normally would not be heard thousands of miles away. Any one of the 100 receivers at Caversham Park in Reading, where the monitors listen to the broadcasts, can select one of 32 aerials at the receiving site called Crowsley Park, about 8 kilometres away. There are also remote receiving sites at places like Helsinki, Stockholm, Warsaw, Almaty, Prague, Kiev, Vienna, Tbilisi, Kuwait, and Peshawar. The system was designed by receiver manufacturer Watkins Johnson.
The Radio Netherlands answer line. If you've something to say, the world is listening.
And the number, Hilversum 724-222. Media Network listener Nikolai Pashkevich in Moscow relays news about Trans World Radio, who it seems have hired airtime now on Channel Africa's transmitters at Meyerton in South Africa. 3 hours of Christian religious programming is being beamed to West Africa in local languages, and further 2 hours are being beamed to East Africa in English and Swahili. Down Under and the Australian Senate inquiry into the running of the ABC has commenced in Sydney. It's being chaired by Senator Richard Alston, opposition spokesperson on communication, and 6 other senators. The opening rounds took place last week. ABC's former managing director David Hill, who recently resigned over allegations on Australian commercial TV that ABC editorial integrity had been compromised, quickly let the senators know what he thought of their inquiry and their terms of reference. He called it a political dog's breakfast. Throughout his questioning, Mr. Hill referred to the problems the ABC had experienced with its funding from successive Australian governments.
The ABC is inadequately funded by its parliamentary appropriation. It always has been. And in real terms, if you look at the history of ABC funding, we've said this many times before, we've suffered the death of 1,000 cuts financially. If you look at what the ABC is expected to do, the range of services it provides and programs it provides right across Australia, it has never had adequate funding. We're very thankful that we've negotiated triennium funding agreements with the government, which for the first time in history protects the ABC from the corrosion of funding through inflation.
The public sector union, which represents most ABC staff, agreed with David Hill. They called on the ABC pay TV licence to be cancelled, the managing director's position to be removed from the ABC board, and for the ABC to pull out of all its pseudo-commercial ventures. Linda Boland of the public sector union also called for the ABC to return to its core role of simply broadcasting.
So what happens is that the first people to get made redundant are the people who make the programs. So in the ABC, the closer you are to making programs, the more vulnerable you are to redundancy.
The inquiry will continue on throughout the new year and should, with any luck, publish its report in late March of 95.
Harold Kuhl, listening in Göttingen in Germany, reports hearing a clear signal from Radio Bosnia-Herzegovina at 1525 UTC on a new frequency of 7108.1 kilohertz. The programme was religious and then went into music. So they're back on the shortwave wireless. Harold's also noticed a later sign-off time for Radio Torch, operating in Ethiopia. The channel of 6210 kHz is active until sign-off at 1730 UTC.
Thanks, Nick. Now to Mike Bird in Melbourne, who has the propagation survey. Mike, what's it been like over the last 7 days?
We experienced one solar flare. The solar flux continued to be high, although it is now declining, and the geomagnetic field was only slightly disturbed last Thursday. An M2 solar flare peaked at 5:41 UTC on Wednesday the 14th. The solar flux started the week at 95, and by Tuesday it had dropped to 82. The average works out to 89.5, and that equals an effective sunspot number of 34, which is up 1 point on the previous week's level. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, ranged between 16 and 6, which represents active to quiet conditions. The magnetic field was generally active between 12 and 18 hours UTC on Thursday the 15th due to a coronal hole on the sun. Since Friday, the magnetic field has been generally quiet.
And what are the predictions over the Christmas weekend?
IPS Radio and Space Services expect solar activity will be low. The geomagnetic field should become active to stormy tomorrow and then active on Saturday. The cause, another coronal hole. From Sunday, that's Christmas Day, until the end of the week, we expect quiet to unsettled conditions to predominate.
Thanks, Mike. And from all of us, if you're celebrating, we all wish you a peaceful Christmas weekend.
Media Network is a Radio Netherlands presentation. Copyright 1994.